This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohen joins us to discuss in detail the leaked draft Supreme Court opinion that might overrule Roe v. Wade.
And I will also discuss the other rights that we take for granted, which are now in jeopardy if the Supreme Court eliminates the constitutional right to abortion.
We speak with attorney Zach Corrigan of Food and Water Watch. We're going to speak with him about the Trump administration getting rid of regulations governing hog slaughterhouses and how dangerous this is for people who consume pork.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Kathy Boudin, a significant figure in the fight against mass incarceration, died on May 1st in New York City. She would have been 79 years old on May 19th, a birth date she proudly shared with Malcolm X and Ho Chi Minh. Kathy was the co-founder with Cheryl Wilkins of the Center for Justice at Columbia University in New York City. She had served 22 years in Bedford Hills Prison, a maximum security prison for women in New York, after pleading guilty to robbery and felony murder in connection with the 1983 Brinks armed truck heist, where she was a passenger in the getaway van. She was a white supporter of the Small Black Liberation Army, which was formed in New York City after the government's destruction of the Black Panther Party. In order to raise funds for the Black Liberation Army, Kathy had agreed to support the action by being in the getaway van to act as a decoy. The robbery went awry. Two police officers and a security guard were killed. Kathy was quickly arrested. She was unarmed and did not kill anyone, but the felony murder law in New York defines a person as guilty if they are a participant in a crime where someone dies. Kathy Boudin was an extraordinarily kind and empathetic person, widely admired with many friends, including me, Michael Smith, the co-host of Law and Disorder Radio. She was proof of the fact that people cannot and should not be defined by the worst thing they've ever done in their lives, and that they are capable of change, transformation, and redemption. An extraordinary organizer, Kathy was able to modify the composition of the New York State Parole Board. Instead of understanding the potential for human transformation, the parole board hearings had only focused on the original crime committed by the applicant and disregarded the good work they had performed in prison and the remorse they had expressed for their crimes. The United States holds more people in prison, 2.3 million, than any other country in the world. Millions of black people are in the criminal justice system, including on probation and parole. Hundreds of thousands have been denied the right to vote and to receive public assistance of any kind. Michelle Alexander calls the situation the new Jim Crow. Kathy understood that the phenomena of mass incarceration was a reaction to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. She was a founder of RAPP, R-A-P-P, Release Aging People from Prison, and a leader in prison justice reform, which has led to a significant drop in the number of incarcerated people in New York State. Kathy was the first woman in New York State to earn a master's degree while in prison, where she developed programs to educate people about AIDS, parenting from afar, and the securing of a college education after the Pell Grant program was discontinued. Kathy was the daughter of the great civil liberties attorney Leonard Boudin, who represented Paul Robeson and Daniel Ellsberg. She was the mother of Chase Boudin, the progressive district attorney in San Francisco, and the sister of retired federal court judge Michael Boudin. We will link to appreciative articles in The Guardian and in The New Yorker about Kathy. Kathy Boudin, presente.
Thank you.
In headline news, on May 3rd, a leaked draft Supreme Court opinion was published in Politico. Samuel Alito's draft decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization would overrule the landmark cases of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Alito writes that abortion is no longer a constitutional right. He leaves it up to the states to enact and enforce laws restricting a woman's right to choose. Alito wrote that, quote, Roe and Casey must be overruled, finding no constitutional right to abortion. If four more conservative members of the Supreme Court agree, which Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett reportedly do at the present time, all reproductive and privacy rights will be imperiled. Our own Marjorie Cohn is here to discuss the privacy and legal ramifications of a Supreme Court decision overruling Roe. Marjorie is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught from 1991 to 2016. She's a former criminal defense attorney and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She lectures, writes, and provides commentary for local, regional, national, and international media. On May 6, Marjorie published an article in Truthout titled, Will Demise of Roe Be a Death Knell for Contraception? Marriage Rights. Marjorie, what a pleasure it is to have you on to discuss this soon-to-be historic legal decision.
Thanks so much, and I wish I could say that it's a pleasure as well, but it's very disturbing, and I'm sure you agree with that.
Yes, well, I'm curious, Marjorie, with the increasingly conservative and religious composition of the Supreme Court, why was the leaked Alito draft opinion still a surprise?
You know, that's a really good question, Heidi. For 50 years, the anti-choice, anti-abortion people have pursued a systematic strategy to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, two right-wing organizations, have come up with lists of judges who will reliably overturn Roe v. Wade, and that is the list from which Trump drew his three Supreme Court nominees who eventually joined the court, and his lower federal court judges, 200 some of them. Nevertheless, in spite of calls for the coming out and voting to have justices, I don't want to say justices, I usually don't call them justices, but members of the Supreme Court who will uphold Roe v. Wade in talking about abortion rights and reproductive rights, the Democrats have been in denial. Obama was asked, I think early in his term, whether he would push and make a priority a law, a federal law, that would codify Roe v. Wade. And he said, no, it's not my priority. You know, he was making a priority of health care and other things. Certainly that has proved to be a major mistake. But now we have a minority in terms of representing people in this country on the Supreme Court, nominated by a president who received a minority of the popular vote, on the verge of overturning Roe v. Wade and possibly many other constitutional rights as well. And yet, it's still a shock. What Alito writes in his draft opinion is that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey must be overturned, and the authority to regulate abortion must be returned to the people and their elective representatives. And according to Politico, four right-wing justices or members of the court, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, voted in December to overturn Roe v. Wade and still maintain that same position. So we will know by the end of June whether Roe v. Wade is indeed dead or not.
Now, Marjorie, let's go back several years. Tell our listeners what the holding of Roe was based on. What legal reasoning?
Well, in 1973, the Supreme Court held in Roe v. Wade that a woman has a right to an abortion until the fetus becomes viable. That's about 23 weeks of pregnancy. And in Roe, the court said that the Constitution protects a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. The court relied on long-standing precedents, holding that the Fourth Amendment's concept of personal liberty prohibits governmental interference with personal decisions about marriage, contraception, procreation, family relationships, child rearing, and education.
Marjorie, I don't think as many people are as familiar with the subsequent case that we've referenced, Casey. Can you tell us why that case was important?
Well, 20 years after Roe v. Wade was decided, the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey reaffirmed the central holding of Roe, that a pregnant woman has the right to an abortion before the fetus becomes viable. And the court said that states cannot limit the right to abortion if it would cause an undue burden on a woman's right, constitutional right to abortion. And Casey highlighted the settled principle that the Constitution places limits on a state's right to interfere with a person's most basic decisions about family and parenthood, as well as bodily integrity. And Casey has been reaffirmed several times since it was decided.
And are there any other rights that Casey serves to protect that would be imperiled if it were overturned?
Yes, indeed, Heidi. The court cited Casey with approval in its decision in Washington versus Glucksberg, in which it listed the right to abortion alongside the rights to marry, to use contraception, to have children, and to bodily integrity, which it said are recognized in a long line of cases that interpret the Due Process Clause. The Due Process Clause requires that the government provide due process, fairness, to people before the government can deprive them of life, liberty, or property. Now, in the case of Lawrence versus Texas, the court again relied on Casey to hold that states cannot criminalize homosexual conduct. And the Lawrence court said that the right to liberty under the Due Process Clause guarantees a realm of personal liberty that the government may not enter. The court then used those same precedents to hold in Obergefell versus Hodges that the Constitution protects same-sex marriage. And the court wrote, quote, like choices concerning contraception, family relationships, procreation, and child rearing, decisions concerning marriage are among the most intimate that an individual can make and are therefore inherent in the concept of individual autonomy protected by the Due Process Clause. Now, there are people suffering early miscarriages or ectopic pregnancies could be adversely affected if Roe is overturned. Fertility procedures such as in vitro fertilization, egg extractions, and stem cell procedures could be outlawed. And what Alito said in his draft was that abortion is an unenumerated right. That means it doesn't appear in the Constitution. It's not written in the Constitution. Well, neither is contraception. Neither is homosexual conduct. Neither is same-sex marriage. Neither is the right to travel. Neither is the right to vote. Neither is the right to interracial marriage, which was enshrined, the right to interracial marriage was enshrined in Loving versus Virginia by the Supreme Court in the 60s. So it's not just abortion that's on the line, and that's not a just, that's a big, big thing, and it's going to have vast ramifications, but also many, many other of our constitutional rights that we've relied upon are fair game with this right-wing Christian theocratic majority that we now have on our Supreme Court.
Now, Marjorie, you are well aware that in the draft opinion that was leaked in the Dobbs case, Alito wrote that the decision concerns only the constitutionality of abortion and no other right, which you have just suggested is not true. Can you paint a quick picture of what a post-Roe society might look like with other rights impacted negatively? Will women, for example, have to leave the state? Will people who do provide abortions be imprisoned?
Well, let me just go back to the Alito draft opinion that said only the constitutionality of abortion is at stake. Alito wrote in this opinion, and by the way, the case we're talking about is the Dobbs case, which is a Mississippi case, which has to do with a Mississippi law that prohibits abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And in this draft opinion in Dobbs, Alito wrote, quote, "We emphasize that our decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion," unquote. Nevertheless, Alito in his draft eviscerates the fundamental underpinnings of the rights to contraception, sexual freedom, and same-sex marriage. He holds that abortion, which is not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, is not deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and is not implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. On the contrary, Alito writes, "An unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment persisted from the earliest days of the common law until 1973, which is when Roe was decided." Well, he's wrong about that. He spent several pages and a 30-page annex citing all of the criminal statutes in states going way back to the, I believe, the 1800s. But abortion was allowed for many years until the quickening of the fetus, and that is generally halfway through the pregnancy, so he was wrong about that. Alito also, and this is really alarming, specifically criticizes Lawrence v. Texas, which says that there's a constitutional right to homosexual conduct, and Obergefell versus Hodges, which says that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. So Alito specifically criticizes both Lawrence and Obergefell, writing that they are not deeply rooted in history. But as Erwin Chemerinsky wrote in the LA Times, unless the court's going to repudiate all of the other privacy rights, it's impossible to deny that laws prohibiting abortion also intrude on a woman's liberty. And in his draft opinion, Alito disavowed the entire line of jurisprudence that undergirds Roe and talks about these unenumerated rights. So even though he said, don't worry, this is only abortion, don't believe it for a minute. Now, back to your second question, what will a post-Roe society look like? About half of the states will outlaw or severely limit abortion. 13 states with so-called trigger laws would immediately ban abortion. 5 states that have pre-Roe abortion bans could once again enforce them. And 14 states would ban abortion before fetal viability. And prohibition of and restrictions on abortion would disproportionately affect poor women and people of color. That means that women who have the means, the financial means, to travel to a state where abortion is legal, such as California, I'm proud to say, can do that. Poor women cannot. But some states are going to criminalize women going to another state to have an abortion. For example, Missouri copied the Texas bounty hunter law. Texas has SB 8, which is a law that says that women can't have abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and it actually deputizes private citizens to sue any doctor or clinic or paramedic or Uber driver who drives a woman to have an abortion and to receive $10,000 and receive attorney's fees. And so under this Mississippi law, private citizens can sue abortion patients who leave Missouri to get an abortion. We will see, and I think most abortions now are medication abortions where people take pills. But even those medication abortions are going to be outlawed. In Texas, Louisiana, Arizona, and several other states, they have banned telehealth over the internet for medication abortion or abortion pills. And we can see additional banning of medication abortions, even if they come from another state or people order them online. Janet Yellen just came out with a prediction that outlawing abortion will have a very, very negative impact on the economy because it will increase the odds of women living in poverty or getting public assistance. And also, I think, and we're going to talk, I know, in a few minutes about parallels between the Dred Scott decision and Alito's draft opinion in Dobbs, but I think what's going to happen ultimately, as state after state criminalizes abortion and many states criminalize leaving states to have abortions, an underground railroad, so to speak, which is an interesting kind of parallel to Dred Scott as well. And that is that there will be systems set up where people seeking abortions can be safely transported to other states. I'm also very proud to say that my state, California, is implementing something called Sanctuary, where there is a fund to help women who can't afford it travel to California for abortions, put them up, lodging, food, transportation, etc. So I think we're going to see ultimately this underground railroad.
Let's talk briefly about stare decisis, what that is for our listeners, and what this particular decision does for that basic legal principle.
Well, stare decisis means that the Supreme Court respects precedent, that they don't lightly overrule prior decisions. In fact, it's like moving heaven and earth to overrule a prior decision. And if Alito and these four right-wingers on the Supreme Court who appear to be ready to vote with him do overturn Roe v. Wade, that would be an egregious violation of stare decisis. Now, Alito said in his draft that stare decisis does not, quote, compel unending adherence to Roe's abuse of a judicial authority. This is after case after case after case of the Supreme Court over the last 50 years has reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. For this Supreme Court, stare decisis is honored only when they like the prior decision, apparently. The Supreme Court has said in a number of cases that while stare decisis is not an inexorable command, even in constitutional cases, the doctrine carries such persuasive force that we have always required a departure from precedent to be supported by some special justification. And that's a quote from many Supreme Court cases. There was a case called Dickerson back in 1999 where the Supreme Court was invited to overturn Miranda. And yet, the majority upheld Miranda. They said, we do not think there is such justification for overruling Miranda. Miranda has become embedded in routine police practice to the point where the warnings have become part of our national culture. Well, it's now evident that the special justification for overruling Roe v. Wade is simply that three new Catholics joined the court thanks to Donald Trump.
Marjorie, Alito discussed eugenics in his draft opinion. Please explain this.
Well, first of all, I want to say that Alito also refers to abortionists, you know, as if they're some kind of executioners. And this language could change by the final opinion at the end of June when these other four right-wingers apparently sign on to the opinion. But Alito also mentioned Clarence Thomas's pet theory about abortion rights being deployed to harm black women and their babies. This is the eugenics argument. Black people accounted for 38% of abortions in 2019 compared to 33% for whites. According to Centers for Disease Control, black people make up about 13% of the population while white people make up 60%. And there are many factors that cause that. Black people are less likely to have access to reproductive health care, good sex education and health insurance, all of which lead to a higher abortion rate. Also, Alito drew heavily on treatises written by an English jurist, Sir Matthew Hale, who described abortion as a great crime and a great misprison. Hale distinguished his career by securing the executions of two women as witches and writing the definitive text for a marital rape exemption that said that husbands cannot be culpable of raping their wives because, quote, by their mutual matrimonial consent and contract, the wife hath given up herself. And so this is just a taste of some of the outrageous things in this draft opinion by Alito.
Marjorie, you mentioned the Dred Scott decision. What parallels are there between Dred Scott and Alito's draft opinion?
Well, This was very well documented in Jesse Jackson's recent Chicago Sun-Times piece, but I think it's striking. The Dred Scott decision was an 1857 decision where a very politicized court ruled that African Americans were not citizens under the Constitution and thus had no rights that a white man needed to respect or that the federal government could protect. And the Dred Scott decision contributed to the political divisions that ended in the Civil War. Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote the Dred Scott opinion. Now, as with Alito's draft, the Dred Scott opinion was leaked ahead of time. And also, like Alito's draft, it was preceded by a disingenuous campaign of lies to urge people to respect the decisions of the Supreme Court because they're grounded in law, not politics. In Dred Scott, Taney relied on a very rigid standard of interpretation that ignored stare decisis. He argued that black people could not be American citizens because at the time of the founding, they were considered beings of an inferior order and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit, unquote. In Alito's draft, he also adopts a rigid standard. He argues the Constitution doesn't contain any words about abortion, that abortion was widely outlawed at the time of the founding of the country. And of course, at the founding, women were not citizens. They didn't have the right to vote. They were regarded as property of their husbands. And the Dred Scott decision left the question of slavery to the states. Alito's draft leaves the question of abortion to the states. And in Dred Scott, Taney reviewed the laws of the original U.S. states, distorting and ignoring history. Alito did the same thing. Taney said that the decision would help temper the growing controversy over slavery that was dividing the country. Alito said that there have been such divisions since Roe that overturning Roe will help reduce political divisions. And of course, we know that's not correct. There are thousands and thousands of people in the streets, and it's really turned the country upside down. And Alito's opinion, overturning precedent of 50 years, at least three judges in the majority said at their confirmation hearing swore that it was settled law when they testified, is really beyond the pale.
Marjorie, as I listen to you, I can't help but think that the damage also goes far beyond liberty for women, that, you know, stare decisis. It also speaks to the integrity and the perceived integrity by Americans of the U.S. Supreme Court. We know that, for example, Congress has a very poor rating in the polls. And I think that with decisions like this, it's got to speak so poorly on institutions of democracy, such as the High Court.
You're absolutely right. And Chief Justice John Roberts is scrambling to protect the legitimacy of his court. He's trying to take a neutral position and not vote to overturn Roe, but still uphold the Mississippi law. But the leak has really thrown them into a tizzy and polarized the country in kind of an unprecedented way. Of course, the Civil War was pretty polarizing. But I think we're going to see repercussions in the midterm elections. Hopefully, it will bring Democrats out to vote for pro-choice governors who can stop some of these anti-abortion state laws. But it's more important than ever that people march, that they write and contact their elected representatives. They write letters to the editor. They write op-eds and do anything we can to stop what looks like a raging freight train to eliminate the right to abortion and many of our other rights.
Marjorie, let's touch base again in early July when the decision is formally released, because it'll be interesting to see if they made any changes since the draft.
Sounds good, Heidi.
And Marjorie, thank you so much for your high-quality work on this topic, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Heidi. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The U.S. Freedom of Information Act is a 1967 law requiring federal agencies to disclose information to the public. The rationale for this law is that a government of, by, and for the people is transparent and accountable to those people. Getting the act passed was a democratic victory of the movement in the 1960s. Over the last half century, FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA requests became critical tools for both journalists and activists seeking to illuminate federal agency activities. The problem is, it's getting harder to wrest information from recalcitrant government agencies. Federal agencies began heavily redacting, that is, blacking out information or ignoring requests entirely. And delays got noticeably longer. The law gives agencies 20 business days to respond. But in 2019, the average wait time for a reply to your FOIA request was nearly 6 months, 177 days. This forces public safety groups to begin expensive and lengthy lawsuits to obtain data that's rightfully ours. Today's guest has experienced this frustrating process, first requesting information, then waiting years for respective agencies to respond. After being granted expeditious processing for a request that would shed critical light on proposed Trump rules, the agency sat on his request for years. He was finally forced to sue. Our guest is attorney Zach Corrigan. He's the champion of food safety. Mr. Corrigan is a senior attorney at Food and Water Watch. In 2018, Mr. Corrigan became concerned when Donald Trump removed 40% of the federal meat inspectors from the slaughterhouse lines and allowed for faster slaughterhouse lines in our nation's hog slaughterhouses. Letting hog slaughterhouses regulate themselves makes foodborne illnesses nearly inevitable because of Trump's rules turned over inspections to the untrained plant employees and rolled back adequate safety testing. COVID should have taught us that human health is inexorably linked to the health of all other animals and the environment, yet even the Biden administration is now pandering to the meat industry by deregulating it. Attorney Zach Corrigan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
And listeners, I want to also welcome as a guest co-host, attorney Tamara Bedick. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild chapter in New York City and the head of their Animal Rights Committee. So, Tamara, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for your help on this. Zach Corrigan, you're the senior attorney for Food and Water Watch and the lead counsel in the case of the United States Department of Agriculture, that's the USDA. Can you tell us a bit about Food and Water Watch? What's your mission?
Certainly, Michael. Food and Water Watch is a national nonprofit organization that is organized to fight for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate. Our focus is really fighting those corporations and other destructive economic interests that put their profits ahead of everything that we all care about. And so that's who Food and Water Watch is.
Zach, what is the USDA's new swine inspection system, or NSIS?
Yeah, so this was a 2019 rule by the Trump administration's USDA that really sought to undo 100 years of food safety regulations. Your listeners probably know about Upton Sinclair and the book The Jungle, which detailed the horrific conditions in the stockyards out in Chicago and the public outcry that that novel engendered. And Congress and Teddy Roosevelt acted and passed monumental piece of legislation called the Federal Meat Inspection Act. And it required that each and every animal get evaluated by a federally trained inspector prior to the animal slaughter, and every single carcass was inspected by such an inspector after. Now, that system had been working. It could be stronger, certainly, but the industry has had its sights on this law for some time now because it really inhibits their ability to produce meat as quickly as they want. Like, they would prefer to produce meat like widgets. And so at the behest of industry in 2019, the USDA sought to undo the Federal Meat Inspection Act by promulgating the new swine inspection system, which had two real fundamental changes. First, it removed inspectors, federal inspectors, from the lines doing tasks like evaluating animals in motion to make sure that they don't have serious physical and mental problems, and then preventing them from stealing lymph nodes and other conditions of animals and carcasses after slaughter. And instead, these responsibilities were given to the plant employees themselves to have primary responsibility to perform what are essentially federal government inspections. Literally, the companies are policing themselves. And because of this, because it's a transfer of authority to the plant employees, this allowed the agency to lift limits on line speeds so that the plants can rev up their lines and produce more hog carcasses, which become the pork that is on all of our plates.
I wanted to ask you about line speed, Zach. Your FOIA request was intended to compare violation rates for carcasses with fecal matter in the pilot program plants versus the violation rate in the traditional slower slaughterhouses. Is that right? And what did you find?
That's right, Michael. This is a great example of how we were able to use the Freedom of Information Act to assist our advocacy work and to assist our eventual litigation challenging this new swine inspection system rulemaking. We filed a Freedom of Information Act back when the agency first proposed this rule in 2018 because the agency had put forward a really conclusory, scant document detailing its justification for these new rule changes, primarily relying on a model system that involved five plants and a limited set of data for these plants that had been operating for the past 15 years. So we filed a FOIA request, and we for folks, for your listeners who are aware of the vagaries of FOIA requests, we're actually granted expedited processing on the request, which is, it is a rarity. I think I've had in my 20-year career a handful granted. But they granted it because we had persuaded them that this data, which was about 27 items, different subject matters of different types of data underlying this new system, we convinced them that this was really necessary for us to be able to comment and assess the rule proposal. Well, the comment period on the rules came and went, and we only had received a few of our documents, types of documents, despite the expeditious processing. And then 6 months later, we still had not received most of our documents. And after the rule was finalized, we finally went ahead and sued to obtain the documents. And one of the things we were most interested in was the performance of these pilot plants that had been operating under the system. The USDA had claimed that these plants had much lower violation rates for fecal matter and digestive contents on carcasses. I mean, this is gross stuff, right? But these are real live living things that when you slaughter them and you eviscerate them, they're internal components, like the fecal matter and digestive content, get on carcasses. And one of the primary things that inspectors do is make sure that the carcasses that end up becoming our pork supply aren't contaminated with fecal matter. And so we were very surprised that the agency, the limited data that it had, showed that with inspectors largely out of the process and with plant employees looking at carcasses, that there was going to be such a lower violation rate for fecal matter and digestive contents on carcasses. And so part of our FOIA request was that we actually looked at this. Eventually, that data we ultimately were able to obtain because of our FOIA litigation.
So were you ultimately able to compare the violation rate of pigs in the traditional slower slaughterhouses versus the pigs killed under the USDA's new swine inspection system? And what did you find when you compared them?
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, this was such a large FOIA request and so many documents, and the agency, as soon as we sued, folded and started producing documents. They didn't put up much of a fight. They knew they were required to provide these records. And, you know, I would get 1,000 pages every couple weeks. And one day, kind of unceremoniously, a document showed up amongst these that the agency had produced, and it was the violation rates for both the plants that had been piloting the new inspection system and large traditional plants. And what do you know? These plants that had been piloting the new system had nearly twice the violation rates for fecal matter and digestive contents than the traditional plants. And the agency, in its report prior to that it had used to justify its new swine system, had tanked the data. It had weighted the data so it made it look like their violation rates were much smaller. It was astounding. I nearly fell off my chair. And this data then became one of the main reasons that we went to challenge the underlying rulemaking for being arbitrary and capricious, because they had failed to consider that actually these plants result in higher violation rates for fecal matter on the carcasses, because what do you know? That's what happens when you have untrained plant employees charged with doing the inspections under this new system.
Let me remind our listeners that we're speaking with attorney Zach Horrigan, who's the lead senior attorney at Food and Water Watch. He's a champion of food safety. Zach, let's make sure we understand what we're talking about here. What kind of contamination do we find? Is this at the micro level, or can you actually see it?
Yeah, that's what's the amazing thing about this. A lot of what makes people sick isn't visible. Pathogens are in our meat supply, like salmonella, and it's very important that consumers cook their meat adequately. And we would like the USDA to do more to regulate these invisible pathogens, but like salmonella. But actually, we're not even talking about this perhaps trickier form of contamination where it requires testing. We're talking about visible feces on the carcass. And the agency has an absolute zero tolerance for carcasses with this contamination because this is how this contamination carries the invisible contaminants, and this is exactly how people get sick. And frankly, even if it didn't have the pathogens, people, when they're buying their meat, expect that when it has a USDA-inspected label on it, they have gone through and made sure that they aren't paying for product that is contaminated with feces. Our data showed that after the carcasses had gone through this privatized inspection process, plants under this new system had close to twice the violation rate that were not in this system. And that meant for the 15% of meat that is currently slaughtered under this kind of pilot system, there was significant levels of fecal matter that was ending up in the product that we all purchase.
Zach, how many Americans get sick or hospitalized every year due to contaminated pork?
Yeah, according to it's quite a few. I think this will surprise some of your listeners. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, contaminated pork alone may cause as many as 1.5 million cases of foodborne illnesses, 7,000 hospitalizations, and 200 deaths each year. So, and this is likely an underreporting. Remember that most of the time when you're sick, you don't know what caused you to get foodborne illness. Oftentimes, people say, "Oh, I got a stomach bug." Well, that's likely foodborne illness, and if it's not serious enough for you to go to the doctor, you may lose a sick day. You may take a sick day. You might not be as productive. It may definitely incur costs, but you're not likely to report it.
Is it your contention that this number would rise under the new Trump system?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to gauge what this would look like, but our experts that we have in helping us assess the system and challenge the new system in court firmly believe that when you diminish government inspections and hand it over to plant employees with no required training, the result is likely to be increased illness. And that's what we're very concerned about.
Attorney Zach Horgan, before I ask you to describe the workforce in these slaughterhouses, I wanted to go back to a point you made before about how these new rules came in. They were the result of lobbying by the industry itself. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. This is a long campaign that the pork producers have pressed to make it so that they can produce pork more cheaply, largely for import and export as well.
Yeah, this is another example of many of the terrible reversal of the situation in a country, in our country, where we now have the fox guarding the chicken coop. Zach, can you describe the workforce in these slaughterhouses? What kind of physical injuries do we see amongst these workers? And what has the Organization of Safety and Health done to ensure workers' safety?
So meat and poultry plants are among the harshest working environments in the U.S. Workers stand close together, side by side, both sides of long conveyor belts, using sharp knives and scissors to cut carcasses. they make the same forceful cuts and movements thousands of times per day. So a typical poultry worker handles dozens of birds per minute. In the holiday months, workers can put in 8 to 10 hour days, 6 or 7 days a week to meet demand. What folks may not know is the meat and poultry slaughtering and process companies report more severe injuries such as amputations and injuries or illnesses that result in overnight stays in hospitals to OSHA than industries that are, you know, popularly conceived of as dangerous, like sawmills or industrial building constructions, oil and gas drilling. The meat industry is a very dangerous industry. And so when we're increasing line speeds, like the pork manufacturers have been pushing to do, it means more injury, more dangerous conditions for workers as well.
So let's talk about COVID rates in these slaughterhouses. Is COVID something you're concerned about?
Yeah. So this was something that we learned of the hard way. The same conditions that are bad for workers in terms of repetitive stress disorder and cutting injuries proved to be disastrous for workers who were exposed to COVID. So you have workers in these plants working close together for long stretches of time. It made these slaughterhouses literally vectors of disease in 2020. An October 2020 report from the House of Representatives found that the largest meat packing companies, which represent over 80% of the market for beef and 60% of the market for pork in the United States, companies you probably have heard of, JBS, Tyson Foods, Smithfield, Cargill, and the National Beef Packing Company, had at least 59,000 meat packing workers infected with Zika virus during the first year of the pandemic in 2020. Sadly, 752 workers have died from the illness, and this is likely an underestimate. The CDC estimates that about 9% of workers were diagnosed with COVID, and that's likely an underestimate as well. Just to demonstrate how much these plants were vectors of this disease, one study in Nebraska found that in the 8 counties with the highest COVID-19 rates were also home to the largest meat processing facilities. So I don't know if many of us realized until this COVID-19 outbreak that it wasn't just these plants are dangerous for the workers, obviously dangerous for consumers and to animals, but also were a public health hazard, dangerous to the surrounding community members as well.
We're speaking with attorney Zach Corrigan. Zach, you mentioned earlier that 40 slaughterhouses produce over 90% of U.S. pork for consumers. That's a really consolidated market, not exactly a monopoly, but what we would call an oligopoly. Is this consolidation bad for consumers?
Absolutely, and that was another lesson that we learned the hard way with COVID. The meat industry, which is very consolidated, was able to use their tremendous economic and then political power to convince the Trump administration to issue an executive order that deemed their workers essential and keep plants open, even though people were getting sick. And even though the U.S. was exporting 30% of its pork, which could have been rerouted to domestic sales. This was not about a shortage of pork. This was a cost that was being borne by the industry. It wanted to continue to export and produce products, and it put its own workers directly in the firing line of this disease, forcing them to continue to work and using their tremendous economic and political power to lobby the Trump administration to allow this to happen.
Now, Smithfield Foods is no longer U.S. owned. Are there other slaughterhouses that are similarly owned by other countries that continue to carry the U.S. name? And if so, how might foreign ownership play into this?
Yeah, I think people would be surprised to know that Smithfield is actually is owned by the China-based WH Group, another big company, the National Beef Company, Beef Packing Company, which is the fourth largest beef processor in the United States, is now approximately 80% owned. Another very large company is JBS. It is a powerful Brazilian company. The Brazilian government actually found that Brazilian meat companies, including JBS, were bribing inspectors. Well, we have two fundamental problems with the consolidation. First, you know, the problem is the economic power of these companies. And the second is that the folks are importing, these companies don't have to comply with standards as rigorous as the United States does. They're supposed to, but in fact, they don't. So, for example, in Australia and Canada, they both have systems that allow for significant private plant inspection. And the USDA has deemed that that's equivalent to the United States system, even though the U.S. system recently finalized it and it's still being challenged in court. We have a petition now to try to revoke this. This summer we revised it because we have discovered that there were an increase in shipments that had to be stopped into the United States from Australia due to fecal matter on beef and lamb from their own privatized inspection system. So it's foreign influence can definitely impact our own local supply as well.
Zach, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you about the pigs themselves. I remember reading in Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, about these pigs. You know, they're very intelligent animals. They're sentient creatures, and they're smart, and they know what's going on. And what I read was that the level of screams and cries in the slaughterhouses themselves are so horrific that it really just affects the workers who are there, too. It's like a Holocaust, in a sense. Can you tell me about the situation there, ventilation, how many pigs are slaughtered in this country annually? Do we export these animals to foreign markets?
So you have to remember, we slaughter 130 million hogs every single year. Hog companies can slaughter 1,106 hogs per hour. So this is the industry that we now face. It is quite an industrialized system.
Well, how can we contact Food and Water Watch?
So our website is foodandwaterwatch.org. And I encourage everybody to check that out. And we also, you can follow us on Twitter at Food and Water.
Excellent. Zach Corrigan, we so much appreciate your being on Law and Disorder today. We want to thank you, and we wish you every best in your work. We totally support you.
Sure. Well, thank you. We can be where our website is foodandwaterwatch.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Food and Water.
Thank you, Zach Corrigan. Thank you, Tamara Bedick, for being our guest host on this show. Zach, we wish you all the best. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.